Good morning. May it please the court. Casey Granis on behalf of Martin Amaya Ontiveros. I'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Double jeopardy prevents multiple convictions for the same offense. In a case like this one, where we have multiple counts that are the same in law and fact, got a double jeopardy problem unless it's manifestly apparent to the jury that each count represents a separate act. That standard's not met here in this case. And that's why the two counts of child molestation for which Amaya was convicted need to be vacated. So in this case, we have four counts at issue. We've got two counts of the child molestation. We've got two counts of the third-degree child rape. Same charging period, separate two-convict instructions. But no instruction tells the jury that they need to rely on a separate and distinct act for each of those counts, and especially in relation to child molestation and the child rape counts in relation to each other. To put it another way, they were never instructed that they cannot rely on the same act of child molestation to also convict on the child rape.
Well, assuming the instructions are, as the case law says, flawed, why is it manifestly apparent? It appeared as though, from reviewing the record, that there was evidence that was that related only to child molestation and evidence that related only to the rape for the four counts.
Well, we have the victim testifying.
Yes, we do.
About various episodes that occurred in different parts of the apartment at issue. We also have the victim testifying that every time an act of child molestation occurred, the act of child rape occurred as well, or nearly every time. And when I use those labels, I'm talking about the child molestation being...
Well, the victim testified about separate incidents related to fondling that were not related to acts of rape.
But we also have the victim testifying that each time the fondling occurred, or nearly every time that the fondling occurred, the oral rape occurred as well.
But not every time. I mean, he did have four different scenarios or scenes he testified about.
Yes.
And in... Go ahead. There you go.
Okay.
Yes, but... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. And each of those scenarios can be described to be distinct, either rape or molestation.
I suppose I could agree they can be. But again, when we're looking at whether a double jeopardy violation occurred on this record, we look to more than just one part of that record. I mean, right now we're focusing on the victim's testimony and how they could and how a jury could have segregated those acts according to his testimony.
Well, that's
part of the analysis.
But we also look to the argument as well as the instructions. So if we look at the argument, don't we have the prosecutor here very carefully walking through the various scenarios and relating them either to counts one or two or counts three or four?
But the problem, though, is that the prosecutor never tells the jury that they can't rely on the same acts between the molestation and the rape.
Well, that begs the question, because, I mean, the question is manifestly apparent. I mean, assuming it's a flawed instruction, we still have to determine whether it's manifestly apparent. And what the Supreme Court says is you look at the evidence, you look at the record as a whole, including the evidence and the arguments, et cetera.
Right. So, and I agree with that, Your Honor. But my point, my micro point I was trying to make is that if the problem starts from not having an instruction telling the jury that they can't rely on the same act, then, at the very least, we would look to the prosecutor's argument to see if the prosecutor related what the instructions omitted.
That didn't happen in Munch.
No, and then we got a bunch of circumstances in Munch, which taken all together show that it was manifestly apparent that there wasn't a double jeopardy problem.
So your argument is that Munch is distinguishable from here,
yes,
from this record, therefore it wasn't manifestly apparent.
Yes. That's the argument. I'm not, coming back to the earlier point and tying it in with Much, State v. Cure makes it clear that the closing argument of prosecution is not enough.
No, I agree with that.
Okay,
but
good.
It's not alone. We've talked about the victim's testimony and the closing argument.
Yeah, so let's talk about how defense counsel attacked or what kind of defense was presented here. What was the cross-examination like of the victim? In Much, there was a situation where the defense was consent. There was no cross-examination mm-hmm. about the number of acts that occur. Okay. In this case, what was missing in Much is present in this case. We've got defense counsel on cross-examination of the victim, impeaching the victim,
mm-hmm.
comparing what he said, the victim said, in these pre-trial interviews with police or the defense, comparing that with what he was testifying to at trial, and in that way providing a basis for the jury to come to a conclusion that, well, given the inconsistencies between the pretrial and the trial testimony, there's a basis to believe that the victim was embellishing the number of acts that occurred. Some of them may have occurred, some not. That's a dispositive distinction between Much. There are others, but I'll try to get to those in rebuttal. Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Amy Meckling for the state. May it please the court. We're asking this court to find first that there was no separate and distinct acts instruction required to be given as between the child molestation counts and the child rape counts. And that's because those crimes are not the same offense for purposes of double jeopardy. They have different elements.
This is your argument that we should disagree with the analysis.
Correct. And I'll explain to you why the analysis in Land is deficient. The analysis in Land, where it talks about they can possibly be the same in law when there's only evidence of oral intercourse and not penetration, that analysis it employs a fact-based conduct analysis that was specifically rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Dixon versus United States and by the Washington Supreme Court in State versus Gockin. Those courts both said, for purposes of double jeopardy, which is the same under the state constitution as the Fifth Amendment, you don't look at the conduct of the defendant that he's charged with, the specific acts that he committed. You look only at the elements of the offense for purposes of double jeopardy. And if they are different in law, if they have different elements, and there is no clear evidence of contrary legislative intent, then multiple punishments are authorized. And Land did not address those cases. It didn't look to those cases at all. It simply employed this fact-based analysis, which conflates the same in law and same in fact test of Blockberger. And we know that you don't do that. And I don't know if the state didn't argue those cases. I don't know what the argument was in Land. I didn't read the briefs. But I know that the court did not address those cases, which seemed to me to be dispositive. And furthermore, Land relied solely on State versus Hughes, essentially, which looked at essentially different crimes. In Hughes, it was second-degree rape and rape of a child, and it found that those were the same in law for purposes of double jeopardy. But it based that decision on an analysis of the elements themselves and not the conduct of the defendant. And it found that the element of rape of a child, which is the age of the victim, essentially is a non-consent element because a child is incapable of consenting. It said that is an element of non-consent that is the same as an element of the non-consent and rape of a second degree when you're talking about an incapacitated victim, because the victim in that case was both a minor and incapacitated.
I think because time's short, you should move to
certainly
manifestly apparent.
Absolutely.
Assume that the instructions were flawed.
Assuming that the instructions were flawed, I disagree with counsel's analysis that this record is not manifestly apparent to the jurors in this case on this record, that the state was neither seeking to impose punishments for the same conviction, nor was that the evidence that was presented. It was clear that we were talking about four separate acts. There were multiple acts. There was more than that. So let's talk first about what you look at. You look at, like the court was discussing with counsel, the testimony of the victim. This victim made very clear that there were he specified at least four specific instances that he remembered over the course of this charging period where there was fondling that had no intercourse, no sexual intercourse, no oral intercourse. Then he testified to other incidents that involved oral intercourse. There was no penetration. In the closing argument then of the state, she specifically references back to that testimony, and her comments make it clear that she is describing the counts of rape and describing the counts of molestation separately. She's talking about fondling with respect to the molestation counts, and she's talking about oral intercourse with respect to the rape counts.
So the argument's been made. First of all, I had a preliminary question, which is when you say manifestly apparent to the jury, is that what we're supposed to be looking at, or are we independently looking at manifestly apparent?
Well, I think you look at whether the record independently makes it manifestly clear that there was not, that there couldn't have been a double jeopardy problem.
And the second question is, apparently we're going to hear more about Munch and how this is not like Munch. What's your position as to Munch and whether this is similar or different and whether that's dispositive?
Well, counsel, his distinction for why you should distinguish Munch was the fact that the defense attorney in Munch, the defendant denied all the counts and just challenged the victim's credibility. If you believe him on one count, you believe him on all the counts,
right.
Therefore there's no double jeopardy problem. That was what happened here. Of course, counsel cross-examined the victim about differences in his story and how it changed over time. He didn't do that to challenge whether there were three incidents, two incidents, or one incident. He did it to establish that none of it happened. Because if you look at counsel's closing argument, what he argued was specifically, if you tell someone that something has happened to you and you tell them that it has happened a certain way one time, and then you tell them later on that it happened a second way, and then you tell them a third time that it happened a third way, they're going to start to question whether it really happened at all. That was how he used these differences in the victim's story, to argue that the victim couldn't be believed and that none of it happened. And don't forget that the defendant took the stand. He wasn't silent in this case. He took the stand, and he denied that any of it happened. He said none of it happened. So that is a distinction without a difference in this case, because, yes, he did challenge the victim on differences in his story about the number of times that it happened and how it happened, but only in a general sense to challenge the victim's credibility altogether, if that makes sense. So that's how you distinguish that case. Well, that's not the only way in which I think that counsel attempted to distinguish that case, but that's the one I heard him talking about the most.
Well, apparently we're going to hear more, so if there are other...
Well, I don't recall other than... I know that there were, I think Munch was an act of sexual intercourse. I don't really recall the specifics. I think that they happened on different incidents or different days, just like it's alleged that have happened here. What you look at, in addition to the evidence and the prosecutor and the defense attorney's argument, you look at the prosecutor's argument. And in this case, as I mentioned earlier, the prosecutor, she specifically said in her closing argument, for purposes of counts 1 and 2, child molestation, what we're talking about is the defendant's fondling of the victim's penis. We're talking about the defendant masturbating and ejaculating on the victim. For purposes of count 3 and 4, the rape of a child counts, what we're talking about here is the defendant performing oral sex on the victim. She's making it clear that she's not talking about the same act. Whenever she talked about rape and molestation to describe the what happened, she talked about it in terms of separate acts. She divided the defendant's behavior between acts that involved sexual intercourse, oral intercourse, and acts that did not.
And didn't that mirror the direct examination where she first asked him about fondling and
yes.
Then asked him about oral sex?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. The one other thing I'll point out that you can look at is because we have separate and distinct acts jury instructions with respect to the two child molestation counts.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have an instruction that tells the jurors that they're to consider each count separately. And we also, unlike Borsheim, where the Borsheim court found particularly troubling the fact that all of the counts were listed in a single two convict instruction. That was part of the problem. They said that could confuse the jury into thinking that they could convict based on the same act. Here you're talking about four separate two convict instructions. Each count was listed in a separate two convict instruction, and the jury was told to consider each count separately. I recognize that standing alone is not sufficient to avoid a double jeopardy problem, but it's another factor that you can look at in the context of the record as a whole in this case in making your determination that there was no actual double jeopardy problem here.
I'd like to change topics for a minute. Can you explain how the requirement, his post-release requirement, to report any dating relationship is crime-related?
I don't recall that. I don't believe defense counsel made the argument. Mr. Amaya Monteveros is not claiming it's not crime-related. I believe he's claiming that it's unconstitutionally vague. So that's an argument that he did not raise in the briefing that I did not address, and I'm not fully prepared to address it today. I think that if you want to talk about whether the conditions are crime-related, a more appropriate one I think for us to talk about is the sexually explicit materials one, because that was raised in the defense briefing as a argument. I don't know if you want to hear about that one.
No, the
dating issue, I mean, here we have charges for being engaged with a minor, and it may, with the age difference, be difficult to describe it as a dating relationship. When we're talking about adults or a heterosexual relationship, the dating restriction would cover those as well. This doesn't seem to be tailored to a prohibition against relationships with minor children.
Well, I can tell you why the court imposes it, generally speaking. Like I said, I didn't address it in the context of this case specifically because it wasn't raised an issue. But generally speaking, the courts impose that condition because whenever you have someone who is a convicted child molester, you're concerned about the dating relationship because child molesters often use their significant other's relationship to get to the significant other's children. That is a common scenario, and that's often why that is imposed.
Then wouldn't it limit it to dating relationships where there are minor children?
I suppose that it could be. The defense could make an argument that it wasn't narrowly tailored to the circumstances and therefore was not crime-related. Again, that's just not something the defense has raised in this case. He challenged it as unconstitutionally vague, which I don't believe it is. Thank you.
Just briefly on the supervision condition, yeah, I raised the constitutional issue, but if this court, under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, were to resolve the issue based on not being crime-related under the statutory standard, of course, this court has the power to do so. Turning to the double jeopardy issue.
Well, before you turn to the double jeopardy issue, what about the issue that, unfortunately, the state didn't get to address, and that's possessing sexually explicit material?
In terms of that, we've got a number of cases saying that, well, if just being convicted of a sex offense, that doesn't involve the actual use of sexual materials or...
Well, wasn't there some testimony about some images on a cell phone here?
There was. And there's a debate about whether that particular point in the record shows that Amaya proffered that phone image to the victim in the context of trying to groom him for sexual contact. The argument from Amaya is that no, that record doesn't actually show that. It just shows that the victim looked at the guy's phone one time and saw that these images were on there.
So is your position that there's no basis in the record for that condition?
Position is that there's not substantial evidence in the record to support that condition. But even if there were on that particular point, we still have the problem with the entry into sex-related businesses. Absolutely zero evidence on that one, and that relates it to the crimes at issue. But of course, Amaya's most important concern here is the double jeopardy one, and I'll return to the much factors and distinguishing much. One factor that the Much court relied on to show that it was manifestly apparent that no double jeopardy violation occurred was that the victim in the Much case specifically testified to the same exact number of counts that were at issue, whereas in this case we've got the victim testifying to more episodes of sexual conduct than were actually charged and instructed. Another basis to distinguish is that in Much, the prosecution discussed every single act in closing argument. And again, every single act matched up to the number of counts that were charged, whereas in this case, we don't have that. We've got the prosecution alluding to how, suggesting to the jury how these counts could be divided up, but the prosecutor is not going through each and every episode.
But the prosecutor does go through the four different scenarios we talked about earlier. does split those scenarios up.
Yes.
And the testimony from the child is that each of those scenarios played out multiple times.
Yes, I agree with that characterization. But the position here is that that's not enough under the manifestly apparent standard. Now, Mutch, I mean, just to step back for a moment, the Supreme Court in Mutch said, you know, it's going to be the rare case where this manifestly apparent standard is met. But, I don't know, the way the state is approaching this issue, again, hammering on the prosecution's argument, hammering on the way the testimony was presented, the way that's presented, that approach basically flips the standard on its head. In other words, it'd be the rare case where the standard wasn't met. That's not the Supreme Court's guidance on this issue. And I ask the court to adhere to that. And just briefly, in terms of defense counsel's attack on credibility, I mean, the focus there is not on defense counsel's intent on why he impeached the witness the way he did. The focus is on how the jury is looking at this and whether they're going to rely on the same act to convict on one on the other. Thank you.
Thank you. Next this morning.